This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Our challenge and the mission that I launched last week has two things. One, AI for everyone to make sure that all Canadians benefit from it. We keep our jobs, our IP safe, our privacy and data safe. Canadians have questions about that. And to make sure that we do it in a timely fashion.
Right. AI Minister Evan Solomon's public consultation on artificial intelligence, framed as a 30-day sprint, wrapped up last week with expectations that the government will unveil a new AI strategy by the end of the year. Much of the emphasis to date is focused on how Canada can ensure that it is an AI leader, with Solomon previously warning about how the government may have over-indexed on AI regulation, or at least AI regulation proposals, given that the AI bill died on the order paper. Mark Sermon, president of Mozilla, has been a leading global voice on digital policy for many years. He occupies an interesting space, Canadian-based leader of the company best known for the Firefox browser, but with a global perspective on digital policy. Mark has been increasingly vocal about the benefits of public AI, with efforts to steer the conversation in a manner that at least accounts for alternatives to the current debate that is often limited to the largest tech companies and debates over digital sovereignty. He joins me on the podcast for a wide-ranging discussion on digital policy, the role of open source, and the benefits of a public AI model. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Michael. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so glad you've come on. You know, Mozilla's been a leading voice on internet policy for a very long time, for many years. Why don't we get started with a little bit of introduction of yourself, the organization, though I suspect many will know it, and especially the role that it's played when it comes to policy, digital policy related issues.
Well, people know Mozilla, but they may not know Mozilla today. Obviously, we're the nonprofit that makes Firefox. It's the thing we're most known for. And, you know, I wasn't here when we built Firefox, but, it really, I think, was a huge contribution, you know, not to policy per se, but to shifting the direction of tech in a values-based sort of direction, right? I mean, Firefox came on the scene when Microsoft really controlled how the whole, you know, web stack was working and opened it up and, you know, created the space for a lot of innovation for Web 2.0, a lot of things, and certainly helped alongside of Linux and other things bring open source into the mainstream. Hard to imagine back 20, 25 years that it wasn't, but, you know, Firefox played a big role. And so that's what Mozilla is best known for. Where we're focused today, you know, and I act as the president of the overall foundation that owns all the different pieces of Mozilla. Where we're focused today is really trying to do for AI what we did for the web. So if Firefox was something that really turned the tide for a while in terms of centralized corporate control, in terms of openness and standards, we think that needs to happen and can happen now with AI. You see such a consolidation and certainly the rules being set by a set of very, very, you know, self-interested, I mean, I guess that goes without saying, venture-backed players. And we're not against business, we're in business as well, but we think that you want diversity, you want choice, and you want values-driven, responsible tech businesses, which, you know, the ones that we run are. And so we really shifted not just to trying to evolve Firefox, Thunderbird, our email software, into can we show what privacy-centric pro-human AI looks like? We're in the early days of trying to figure that out, cautiously, not moving in fast and breaking things like everybody else around us, but also have spun up a separate company, a separate venture arm, really focused on open source AI and trying to make sure that we can have an era where everybody gets to innovate.
Okay, oh, that's super interesting, and I really want to get into sort of those aspects of your engagement with AI. Before we get into some of what we've seen from a Canadian AI policy perspective, have you been involved in sort of some of the some more recent efforts around Canadian digital policy. We saw it with internet regulation, we saw it with online harms, it's popped up, we saw it with privacy and ill-fated attempt at AI regulation. Were you part of that public debate, or have you engaged in Canadian policy in that way in the past?
I have a very funny life, which is I live in Canada, I love being in Canada, but I kind of, you know, am not that engaged in the Canadian policy scene. So certainly, you know, we play a lot on policy in Brussels and in DC and in an international standards body. You know, so we did a lot in the AI Act in Europe. We think the AI Act actually is a good thing by and large. I mean, it's tricky in terms of implementation, it's tricky in terms of standards. And we were particularly focused on making sure that, you know, you had the right balance between making sure that we're looking at risks and allowing, in particular, open source to thrive as a kind of innovation that, you know, if you regulate the wrong way, you can just kind of chill people doing open source work. And so, you know, we played a big role in that in the DMA and DSA in Europe, certainly in a lot of quite frustrating regulatory battles in the US because it is hard to pass laws there, but also playing a bunch of, I think, helpful defense on the AI front. So, you know, SB 1047 in California, which was an AI bill, and I think well-intentioned AI bill focused on risks, was written in a way that it just would have, you know, kneecapped open source. And so we and others kind of helped avoid that. So a lot of what we've done is really has been focused on the US and Europe. I do watch the Canadian scene. And if you kind of think about C27 and sort of, it was very, I don't know, confounding to me that we tried to glue in Canada an AI bill and a privacy bill together. We've needed a good privacy bill and updated a privacy bill in Canada for so long. And there was a lot that was good on that side of it. And then it just seemed, you know, like wrongheaded, and I think got stuck because you tried to do a too far reaching, not well enough thought through AI bill kind of all meshed in together. So I guess word on the street, and I think you know, your ear is to the ground more than mine, is that that'll come back, but it'll come back as separate pieces, which I think is a much more sensible approach.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that, and that is certainly what we are hearing. Yeah, I want to talk a bit about some of those AI acts. You provided a bit of a hint there just a moment ago, but at the heart of both some of the AI legislation and that, and Bill C-27 that, you know, brought together both privacy and AI have of course been trust. I mean, the idea that government can play a role in trying to better facilitate trust. At times we hear from some of the players in the ecosystem talking about some of their technology solutions or other initiatives that seem designed to foster trust. You have ideas about how sort of that combination of regulation, design, even civic engagement can work together to bring back some of the public trust in technology. It feels that we're at a lower ebb at the moment where there is increased skepticism and sometimes fear of where some of this technology is taking us.
Yeah, man, Michael, that is just such a big question. And it involves all of those things, product design, regulation, I guess, you know, you call it civic engagement. I just think community and just like listening to people and having them shape where tech goes. And, you know, we, I think, did a good job at building trusted technology and a trusted brand in the web era by being a nonprofit. And so, you know, yes, we have commercial businesses under that, but our incentives are really with the public. And I think having, and you see the same thing with Signal, you see the same thing with Wikipedia, frankly, you see the same thing historically with public broadcasting. And so I think one part of trust is having effectively public options in the market. And we sometimes forget that. I really think more of that rather than less of that is important. And then, you know, those can also be public benefit corporations or B Corps, but some accountability to somebody other than just money making is, to me, an important piece to have that choice in the marketplace if we want trust. And then the other is just showing that you have users' interests in mind. And I think it's interesting, both polling and I think just kind of the vibe you get shows that people trust Apple more than a lot of other players because they do some things focused on privacy. You can shoot holes in that. You can say a lot of it's marketing, and you can say it's only for the wealthy, which because it's Apple, it is. But you know, they do design, as do we, from a perspective that actually takes privacy into account as a design principle. And so I think that's the other piece is product design that looks at people's interests. And I think in the AI era, that is going to have to be not just privacy, what happens with my data, is something going on here where my information, you know, I've pasted health information into this chatbot. Do I feel safe that I'm getting the answer back, but it's not going to somebody else? It's not just that kind of traditional sense of privacy. It includes that. I think there's also a piece around trust and agency. Am I basically able to express my interests in a way that the system that has a lot of automation in it is going to respect my interests? And one of the things that I wonder about is whether we can have trust in the model we have now, where all of the AI, all of the kind of the power of the technology is in the companies that provide it to me, and none of it is really on my side. I mean, a lot of the conversations that feel they've gone out of vogue around, you know, digital fiduciaries or data trust or those kind of things, I think we need to get back to is, can we have tech that is just there in an automated world of agents that is only accountable to me, that negotiates with all the other thousands of automated systems coming at me all the time? And I think, you know, some interventions around trust there are going to be, those things are going to be important if we want to get trust back.
Okay, that's interesting. I want to get to the sort of that public interest AI or public AI and the role of open source. We'll do it in just a sec. But before we get to that, you know, listen, I'm a law prof. When you're a law prof, everything looks like a legal issue. And so I want to stick to that for just a moment. You mentioned you were involved or had involvement in the EU AI Act. So we've now seen this sort of first generation of AI regulatory approaches, the EU, the shift we've seen most recently in the United States, and of course, Canada's failed effort on C27. Can you talk a bit about your perspective on what we have right now when it comes to regulating AI? And in some instances, we don't have very much, but what's your thoughts on what the regulatory landscape looks like when it comes to artificial intelligence?
You know, it's a, we could spend five podcasts just kind of going down that path, as you know. Well, you probably spend five classes in your law classes doing that. But you know, at the top level, I might say the pretty generic thing that we're just early days, and that's fine. And so I think if early days, if we think of the EU AI Act as the thing that has gone the farthest, or at least is most notable in terms of dedicated AI regulation, starting from the perspective that what we're trying to do is regulate high-risk things. And so people who don't know the EU AI Act, it is focused on, you know, high-risk uses of AI, like say in healthcare or insurance or in aspects of government, and making sure that there's a clear accountability chain if, you know, bad things happen in those higher or medium risk categories. It's not focused on just anything you might use AI for to run a checkers game or something like that. And so starting from that perspective of there are areas that we can see real risk to people and the economy and society, and trying to have an accountability chain for that when we come from an era of no software liability. I mean, there's very few product categories that are like software where, you know, bad things can happen and the people who made it aren't, there's no liability. So I think we're moving more towards a regime of liability for digital goods that is needed. You also, these are adaptive systems. They're not built like a bridge or a car where you know in advance exactly how everything's going to play out. So writing laws to deal with risks for adaptive, evolving systems is super tricky. We just, you know, certainly the systems have changed so much, even by the time the ink is dry on the law, much less over a course of decades. And I think there's just a real need for regulatory innovation for how we deal with systems that are adapting and evolving so quickly. And you know, we haven't cracked that yet. So I think it's early days. The EU AI Act has bitten off some of the right things, but then how you implement it is tricky. And then, you know, obviously you talked about the shift in the US. The US was going down a path of that sort of, you know, rights-based regulation. I don't know that it really would have ever made it into law in the ways that it has in the EU. So there was a lot of interesting signaling from the White House. And I think some of the most interesting stuff kind of showed up in things like procurement policy that the White House could direct. But, you know, obviously the tides have changed, and you're not going to see that in the US. And I think we just have to accept that and look at where we can have an impact with regulation in other jurisdictions over the coming period.
Yeah. So speaking of other jurisdictions, let's come back.
Here we are in one of them.
Exactly. Let's come back to Canada for just a sec. So we find ourselves situated between, you know, what you've described, the EU AI Act as biting off at least some of these issues. We've seen the shift away from that, a more innovation-focused approach from the U.S. with certainly fewer guardrails at a minimum. The new AI minister, Evan Solomon, talks about having over-indexed on regulation in the past, a reference to C-27 and law that was on the AI portion of it, largely modeled on the European approach. You know, is your perspective, is that a cause for concern? Where does Canada fit in this, do you think? Can we manage to find a space that is either uniquely Canadian, or do we have to be a fast follower to one of the existing models that are out there?
You know, it's a tricky thing, and you know, maybe this is a place where we get in an arm wrestle, or maybe you can teach me something, because I struggle with this. Is it's so hard in digital goods to know where us making that kind of regulation can be effective given how small the market is. And so, you know, some of the stuff around it coming out of the AI Act, which is really about deployment of higher risk systems, that could make sense because you have Canadian companies in Canadian jurisdictions deploying systems that you want to make sure they're doing safely. And so I do think that is interesting. But when you're talking about, you know, bigger systems that are operating across jurisdictions, it's really hard. I mean, we've seen this with, you know, how Facebook has, you know, cut us out of the news universe in ways I think have been very disastrous politically, or at least, you know, in terms of the information environment. We're just such a small player that if we try to, you know, just the effectiveness of a lot of kinds of digital regulation is going to be limited. So I don't actually have the same analysis that the minister has, that we've overregulated. I don't think we've regulated effectively, but I think it's very hard for us to do so, except for at the deployment and implementation layer of digital goods. And that's a sad thing to say, but is we're in a global digital economy. The thing I would say that I'm hopeful for with this minister and with this task force is that where we can have real leverage is through industrial policy, but a very different lever than regulation. And I do think industrial policy that is about setting us up to have a values-based digital economy and to work with other democracies and other countries that you know, are focused on open markets and are not trying to be isolationist. You know, that's where this idea of public AI comes in, the idea that we could build public goods that have the government's actually able to shape things through investment and deployment and values, and not just through regulation, you know, which we've done before in transportation systems or public broadcasting or so on. I think industrial policy that encourages a particular kind of digital goods that are economically inclusive, and again, that take into account rights and democracy. That's where I would be looking in the very near term for us. And I'm, as I say, I'm hopeful that that can happen, although I have some worries too.
That suggests there's at least a couple of pathways that, let's say, the Minister Solomon might have. He might have the regulatory approach and trying to figure out, you know, what can Canada do? And frankly, I think we're largely in agreement. I think that some of Canadian digital policies in the past have been at best just naive about how global players would react to sort of like this Canadian specific solution that created significant additional costs of operating in the market. And the prospect that some might well walk away was something that was deeply discounted by government, but has proven to be just the reality.
It's not going
to
be true.
Yeah. So there is, it is a limit. The sandbox is smaller than we might otherwise hope from a regulatory perspective, but then there are some other possibilities. You did reference the task force or the expert advisory group that the government has set up. There have been some concerns about both the speed with which it is looking to move. The government's talking about it as a sprint, but by the time this episode drops, we may be at the tail end of that process in terms of the committee itself working on these issues. They've got 26 members. Many of those members are coming from some of the larger players. There are perspectives in there that people have noted are not included. You have some thoughts on that lane? Well, I'd like to talk about both. Your thoughts on the lane that the government has at the moment in terms of saying, well, we want to come up with some regulatory ideas and we want to do it really, really fast. And we're going to use this process as the mechanism to do it.
Well, you know, I think they do have some usual suspects on that list of the expert group, but they also have some less usual ones, or ones that, you know, just knowing them personally or seeing what they're thinking, I'm optimistic about. So it's like, who do they listen to? I think Joelle Pinault, who, yes, she came from Meta, as a McGill professor in AI before, but she worked in the research group at Meta that produced Llama and really broke open open source AI. And she's now at Cohere as their chief AI officer. And she's got really sharp thoughts on sort of how we design systems that could be for Canada, but also global and open. And similarly, Marcus Shannon Roumet, who was at Element AI, also did a brief stint at AWS, has done a lot of thinking on kind of where Canada can really find an edge through open source. And so my hope is that some of those voices really get listened to. I don't think that they, or frankly, many people are going to focus on the regulatory piece, and you probably will have a fairly, let's say, regulatory cautious set of voices from there, but you've already heard that the minister wants to kind of take that stance. I don't expect a change there. We could talk about what we could wish for there, and I certainly would hope some regulation around deployment is on the table. But what I do think you will get from some of that is some of this industrial policy, which I hope has takes the stated ambition for sovereignty and turns it into an opportunity to invest in public goods and invest in open source, which doesn't mean just a Canada-only strategy. And I think that's a real risk. When I talk to policymakers in Ottawa, because they have been a little bit on this file, or in Paris, or in Berlin, or in the UK, although I think they've taken a bad path. There's a desire for digital sovereignty, but then it risks going internal. Like, let's build for Canada, let's build for Germany, let's build for France. And none of these countries have enough resources to do anything on their own. And open systems and collaboration amongst democracies on digital public goods, to me, is the only way to build a kind of a third alternative between the US platforms and the Chinese model. And so that's a thing I hope that the minister can hear, is working with our allies that are focused on democratic open economies on digital public goods is the only path to getting the economic independence we want and the digital sovereignty we want.
Okay. Why don't we back up just a second, and I want to explore this notion of digital public goods and, what can be done. Can you start by explaining what do you mean when you say digital public good, and how does that fit in with some of the things that Mozilla is doing?
Well, when I talk about digital public goods, I don't only mean open source, but let's take open source as an example. You take Linux, or you take Firefox, you take web standards, the HTML and JavaScript and these things that you can use to build a website or a web app with. All of these are licensed publicly or owned in the public domain in some way, that means anybody can build on them. And you know, that's been a tremendous boon for innovation. There's also negative side effects to some of that. There's so many of those kinds of open digital public goods you know, underpinning the internet. And I think you can go beyond that to data sets or to infrastructure that would be used by Canadian businesses, or compute that would be available as public goods for Canadian researchers or Canadian artists or Canadian businesses. So you can imagine a lot of different kinds of digital public goods, all of which basically are a leg up so that you can, you know, have many of the same starting points that these bigger players have, but as a smaller player, whether that's a smaller player as a country or a smaller player as an individual business or researcher or whatnot. And, you know, the trend is towards more of these open source public goods in the AI universe, but they really need intent and investment in order to become the mainstream, like much like Linux became the mainstream and replaced Microsoft and Sun in the server room 20 years ago or 15 years ago. And so in governments with intent, using their dollars, their compute dollars, their research dollars, their procurement dollars towards creating or buying those digital public goods increases the likelihood that we're not renting from OpenAI or Google, but we're actually taking what is available freely and running it on our own terms, running it on our own servers as we improve it, improving things that are back into the pool of digital public goods. So that's really what I mean. And I think if you can't do that, if you say take OpenAI's offer, which is to do, you know, AI for countries, and you know, do an instance of OpenAI on stuff that happens to be on Canadian soil, I don't think you have that that freedom, that independence, that sovereignty. You know, you're just a renter on your own land.
Okay, interesting. Now, it seems to me it's easier to conceive of what you're describing in the context of compute. I mean, that feels like physical facilities. Hey, government, put some money into this so that we have a viable alternative that is domestic based, and you can make the policy case that you've just described. You can weave in some of the privacy related issues about data being here. I mean, there's a bunch of different things you could point to. How does this fit with some of the other pieces though? So let's say large language models or some of the other elements that feed into AI. How do we Canadianize that, so to speak, and how do you think policy or the government fits into that?
Well, let's take large language models as one example. Right now, there are no truly open source large language models that are at the kind of level of performance of GPT-5 or even a Qwen, which is one of the Chinese open weight models, or DeepSeek, or even Llama. But there are, and when I say truly open source, I mean that the underlying data is publicly available and known, that the training code is publicly available and known, and of course that the model itself is freely available and configurable, which is often referred to as open weights. And it's important to have those things so that you actually can use it and adapt it to your own languages, your own culture, and also protect it and have it be transparent and inspectable. So, you know, say we wanted really to have LLMs that worked in a lot of indigenous languages and not just in French and English, being able to have these truly open systems helps with that. But of course, you know, one of the reasons that these things are not as performant as the semi-open models or the very closed models is it takes a lot of resources to get there. And so if you layer on the compute piece, you could take the research compute or even the kind of compute that goes to a company like Cohere in Canada and say the compute that's, you know, there's 10,000 GPUs in the Swiss, you know, kind of supercomputer lab, and there's, you know, stuff being built in Germany or in Korea or in Japan, and look at collaboratively building these truly open large language models in a way that actually together the governments of these economies have tons of resources to be able to have top performing large language models. And I think, you know, it could be the same with other elements of the stack, orchestration software, many of the different kinds of data sets you would want in order to build digital public goods. So it's really, the key of it is we can create, as the whole tech industry does with Linux, top performing AI systems that are truly open digital public goods if we pool our resources and then rely on them collectively.
Are there any issues there? Once you start getting into different jurisdictions, just sticking, for example, with the large language model example, I mean, we've seen any number of copyright issues, for example, pop up around some of these large LLMs. So we're dealing both with copyright issues, certainly, of course, on the outputs at times, whether or not they infringe, but very much, much more the focus tends to be on the input and the use of this data. Are there concerns, or do you have concerns about what does that mean when you start engaging cross-border, different countries, different copyright laws, different text and data mining exceptions? I mean, there are a whole series of differences that may create some amount of barriers here.
I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I think across a lot of these things, but certainly on copyright, the open source stuff brings it to the fore because you can see what's being done. And then you have to work through and possibly even make compromises on the legal regimes or just contracts and agreements around copyright. And we should remember, like, the whole history of open source is a hack on copyright, right? It's a contract. It's not a law. And so I think if we have the intent to build digital public goods, there's opportunities for contractual and legal innovation. And, like, we'll have to confront the tough issues. Whereas all these other things which do work across borders are primarily based on theft and obfuscation. Like, there's no question that there were copyright laws being broken by the big closed systems. It's not like the issues you're talking about go away. It's just that they're hidden and well defended.
I think there are some questions, but we're seeing some of those questions play out in the courts right now. But certainly it is a top of mind issue.
But I don't think those questions are unique to open source, is my point. And I think you tend to, when I look at, a lot of the open source projects in this space, have a community of people who are trying to ethically and honestly resolve the data ownership and copyright questions, as opposed to what you're really mostly seeing in the courts is where the big players are just trying to avoid the issue and they're getting called out.
No, I think that's true. So this is super interesting. Why don't we close with this? You mentioned that you've had these discussions with policymakers in a number of different places, including here in Canada. I'm curious about what kind of response you get when these ideas get raised. I think, for example, right now in this sort of so-called elbows up movement in Canada, or at least it was several months ago.
I hope it's still true. Fingers crossed.
It's not clear. They're kind of wavering at times, it seems. But regardless, at that moment, the idea of coming forward and saying, hey, the solution here is to, you solve sovereignty issues not by sort of locking things down here in Canada, but actually finding ways to go across borders and make different kinds of connections and like-minded groups. So that may be a tough message for certainly some policymakers. I'm curious as to what kind of response are you getting and how do you see this evolving in the months ahead?
Well, I think you get a mix of responses. Certainly in theory, for 10% of the cost, we could have digital sovereignty by working with our allies because we're going to pool resources. Sign me up. And I mean, I had the kind of main AI person for, the head of a major European country say, like, give me the blueprint. And so I think the initial thing is that. But then, the combination of, it's hard to imagine collaborative economics and the collaborative economics of open source in particular, if you haven't lived them. They're just counter to, the kind of public narrative around, the kind of rivalrous goods and kind of how the economy works. And so I think you have to get people's, that you have to get people to believe that this kind of resource pooling works. And there's a bit of a leap of faith or kind of looking at examples from history. And then, of course, you have you have a lot of lobbying money in every country that will kind of say, wink, wink, yeah, sure. But, you know, actually sovereignty is like, buy it from us. I mean, I was on a panel in a big conference in Germany earlier this year, and I had the kind of European head of policy for Microsoft. And, you know, his answer to digital sovereignty is, you know, you guys put some servers here in Europe. Don't worry, we'll give you the rest. And for me, that is not actually the answer, but there's a lot of lobbying dollars that say it is.
Interesting. The response of Microsoft to questions in France, I guess several months later, when asked about whose law would apply, was an acknowledgement, well, in some instances, we might have to abide by U.S. law, not local law. So it's quite clear that merely putting the computer, the physical resources.
I agree. And I think we're learning that and pushing that. And frankly, you know, open source that is operated and deployed by companies and countries themselves is, you know, a much faster path to real independence.
Interesting. Well, listen, you're doing clearly some super interesting work. And, you know, as our own government begins to try to piece through some of these issues and identify a path forward for Canada, you know, I think this conversation's really highlighted that sort of that perhaps even law professors need to start thinking beyond the legal and the regulatory piece, that that's a piece, but it's part of a much larger puzzle that needs to be solved. So thanks for the work
Indeed.
That you're doing, and thanks for coming onto the podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was a lot of fun.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbitespod, or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca, or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo Lebron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose Lebron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.